The first two had blocked the road in a V. Firemen were already spilling out and unrolling hoses. Duke could hear the warble of an ambulance from the direction of Castle Rock. Where's ours? He wondered. Had it also gone to that stupid damn training exercise? He didn't like to think so. Who in their right mind would order an ambulance to an empty burning house?
There seems to be an invisible barrier, Rennie began.
Yeah, I got that, Duke said. I don't know what it means, but I got it.
He left Rennie and went to his bleeding officer, not seeing the dark red color that suffused the second selectman's cheek at this snub.
Jackie,
Duke asked, taking her gently by the shoulder.
All right.
Yeah.
She touched her nose where the blood flow was slowing. Does it look broken? It doesn't feel broken.
It's not broken, but it's going to swell. Think you'll look all right by the time the harvest ball comes around, though.
She offered a weak smile.
Chief, Rennie said, I really think we ought to call someone on this. If not Homeland Security, on more mature reflection, that seems a little radical.
Then perhaps the state police.
Duke moved him aside. It was gentle, but unequivocal. Almost a push.
Rennie balled his hands into fists, then unrolled them again. He had built a life in which he was a pusher, rather than a pushy. But that didn't alter the fact that fists were for idiots. Witness his own son. All the same, slights needed to be noted and addressed, usually at some later date. But sometimes, later was better. Sweeter.
Peter, Duke called to Randolph, give the health center a shout and ask where the hell our ambulance is. I want it out here.
Morrison can do that, Randolph said. He had grabbed the camera from his car and was turning to snap pictures of the scene.
You can do it, and right now.
Chief, I don't think Jackie's too banged up, and no one else.
When I want your opinion, I'll ask for it, Peter.
Randolph started to give him a look, then saw the expression on Duke's face. He tossed the camera back onto the front seat of his shop and grabbed his cell phone.
What was it, Jackie?
Duke asked. I don't know. First there was a buzzy feeling like you get if you accidentally touch the prongs of a plug when you're sticking it into the wall. It passed, but then I hit... Jeez. I don't know what I hit. An ah sound went up from the spectators. The firemen had trained their hoses on the burning pulp truck, but beyond it, some of the spray was rebounding, striking something and splattering back, creating rainbows in the air. Duke had never seen anything like it in his life. Except maybe when you were in a car wash, watching the high-pressure jets hit your windshield. Then he saw a rainbow on the mill side as well. A small one. One of the spectators, Lissa Jameson, the town librarian, walked toward it.
Lissa, get away from there, Duke shouted.
She ignored him. It was as if she were hypnotized. She stood inches from where a jet of high-pressure water was striking thin air and splashing back. Her hands spread. He could see drops of mist sparkling on her hair, which was pulled away from her face and bunned at the back. The little rainbow broke up, then reformed behind her.
Nothing but mist, she called, sounding rapturous. All that water over there, and nothing but mist over here. Like from a humidifier.
Peter Randolph held up his cell phone and shook his head. I get a signal, but I'm not getting through. My guess is that all these spectators, he swept his arm in a big arc, have got everything jammed up. Duke didn't know if that were possible, but it was true that almost everyone he could see was either yakking or taking pictures. Except for Lissa, that was, who was still doing her wood nymph imitation.
Go get her, Duke told Randolph. Pull her back before she decides to haul out her crystals or something.
Randolph's face suggested that such errands were far below his pay grade, but he went. Duke uttered a laugh. It was short, but genuine.
What in the goodness sakes do you see that's worth laughing about? Rennie asked.
More Castle County cops were pulling up on the Motton side. If Perkins didn't look out, the Rock would end up taking control of this thing and getting the gosh darn credit. Duke stopped laughing, but he was still smiling, unabashed.
It's a cluster mug, he said.
Isn't that your word, Big Jim?
And in my experience, sometimes laughing is the only way to deal with a cluster mug.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Rennie almost shouted.
The Dinsmore boys stepped back from him and stood beside their father.
I know,
Duke spoke gently, and that's okay. All you need to understand right now is that I'm the chief law enforcement officer on the scene, at least until the county sheriff gets here, and you're a town selectman. You have no official standing, so I'd like you to move back.
Duke raised his voice and pointed to where Officer Henry Morrison was stringing yellow tape, stepping around two largish pieces of airplane fuselage to do it.
I'd like everyone to move back and let us do our job. Follow Selectman Rennie. He's going to lead you behind the yellow tape.
I don't appreciate this, Duke, Rennie said.
God bless you, but I don't give a shit, Duke said. Get off my scene, Big Jim, and be sure to go around the tape. No need for Henry to have to string it twice.
Chief Perkins, I want you to remember how you spoke to me today, because I will.
Rennie stalked toward the tape. The other spectators followed, most looking over their shoulders to watch the water spray off the diesel-smudged barrier and form a line of wetness on the road. A couple of the sharper ones, Ernie Calvert, for instance, had already noticed that this line exactly mimicked the border between Motton and the mill. Rennie felt a childish temptation to snap Hank Morrison's carefully strung tape with his chest, but he restrained himself. He would not, however, go around and get his Land's End slacks snagged in a mess of burdocks. They had cost him $60. He shuffled under, holding up the tape with one hand. His belly made serious ducking impossible. Behind him, Duke walked slowly toward the place where Jackie had suffered her collision. He held one hand outstretched before him like a blind man prospecting his way across an unfamiliar room. Here was where she had fallen down. And here. He felt the buzzing she had described, but instead of passing, it deepened to searing pain in the hollow of his left shoulder. He had just enough time to remember the last thing Brenda had said. Take care of your pacemaker. And then it exploded in his chest with enough force to blow open his Wildcat sweatshirt, which he'd donned that morning in honor of this afternoon's game. Blood, scraps of cotton, and bits of flesh struck the barrier. The crowd awed. Duke tried to speak his wife's name and failed, but he saw her face clearly in his mind. She was smiling. Then, darkness.
4. The kid was Benny Drake, 14, and a Razor. The Razors were a small but dedicated skateboarding club, frowned on by the local constabulary, but not actually outlawed, in spite of calls from Selectman Rennie and Sanders for such action. At last March's town meeting, this same dynamic duo had succeeded in tabling a budget item that would have funded a safe skateboarding area on the town common behind the bandstand. The adult was Eric Rusty Everett, 37, a physician's assistant working with Dr. Ron Haskell, whom Rusty often thought of as the Wonderful Wizard of Oz, because, Rusty would have explained, if he'd anyone other than his wife he could trust with such disloyalty, he so often remains behind the curtain while I do the work. Now he checked the state of young Master Drake's last tetanus shot. Fall of 2009, very good. Especially considering that young Master Drake had done a Wilson while cement shooting and torn up his calf pretty good. Not a total Jake, but a lot worse than simple road rash.
Power's back on, dude, young Master Drake offered.
Generator dude, Rusty said. Handles the hospital and the health center. Radical, huh?
Old school,
young Master Drake agreed. For a moment, the adult and the adolescent regarded the 6-inch gash in Benny Drake's calf without speaking. Cleaned of dirt and blood, it looked ragged, but no longer downright awful. The town whistle had quit, but far in the distance, they could hear sirens. Then the fire whistle went off, making them both jump. Ambulance is gonna roll, Rusty thought. Sure as shit. Twitching Everett right again. Better hurry this up. Except the kid's face was pretty white, and Rusty thought there were tears standing in his eyes.
Scared?
Rusty asked.
A little, Benny Drake said. Ma's gonna ground me.
Is that what you're scared of?
Because he guessed that Benny Drake had been grounded a few times before, like, often, dude.
Well, how much is it gonna hurt?
Rusty had been hiding the syringe. Now he injected 3 cc's of xylocaine and epinephrine, a deadening compound he still called Novocaine. He took his time infiltrating the wound, so as not to hurt the kid any more than he had to.
About that much.
Whoa, Benny said. Stat, baby. Code blue.
Rusty laughed.
Did you full pipe before you Wilsoned?
As a long-retired boarder, he was honestly curious.
Only half, but it was toxic, Benny said, brightening.
How many stitches do you think Nori Calvert took 12 when she ledged out in Oxford last summer?
Not that many, Rusty said.
He knew Nori, a mini-goth whose chief aspiration seemed to be killing herself on a skateboard before bearing her first woods cold.
He pressed near the wound with the needle end of the syringe.
Feel that?
Yeah, dude, totally. Did you hear, like, a bang out there?
Benny pointed vaguely south as he sat on the examining table in his undershorts, bleeding onto the paper cover.
Nope, Rusty said.
He had actually heard 2, not bangs, but he was afraid explosions. Had to make this fast. Where was the wizard? Doing rounds, according to Ginny, which probably meant snoozing in the Kathy Russell doctor's lounge. It was where the wonderful Wiz did most of his rounds these days.
Feel it now? Rusty poked again with the needle.
Don't look, looking is cheating.
No, man, nothing, you're goofing with me.
I'm not, you're numb.
In more ways than one, Rusty thought.
Okay, here we go, lie back, relax, and enjoy flying Kathy Russell Airlines.
He scrubbed the wound with sterile saline, debrided, then trimmed with his trusty number 10 scalpel.
6 stitches with my very best 4-0 nylon.
Awesome, the kid said. Then I think I may hurl.
Rusty handed him an emesis basin, in these circumstances known as a puke pan.
Hurl in this, faint, and you're on your own.
Benny didn't faint. He didn't hurl either. Rusty was placing a sterile gauze sponge on the wound when there was a perfunctory knock at the door, followed by Ginny Tomlinson's head.
Can I speak to you for a minute?
Don't worry about me, Benny said. I'm like freely radical.
Cheeky little bugger.
In the hall, Rusty, Ginny said.
She didn't give the kid a glance.
I'll be right back, Benny. Sit there and relax.
Chillaxin', no prob.
Rusty followed Ginny out into the hall.
Ambulance time? He asked.
Beyond Ginny, in the sunny waiting room, Benny's mother was looking grimly down at a paperback with a Sweet Savage cover. Ginny nodded.
119 at the Tarker's town line. There's another accident on the other town line, Martin, but I'm hearing everyone involved in that one is DATS.
Dead at the scene.
Truck-plane collision. The plane was trying to land.
Are you shitting me?
Alva Drake looked around, frowning, then went back to her paperback. Or at least to looking at it while she tried to decide if her husband would support her in grounding Benny until he was 18.
This is an authentic no-shit situation, Ginny said. I'm getting reports of other crashes, too.
Weird.
But the guy out on the Tarker's town line is still alive, rolled a delivery truck, I believe. Buzz, cuz. Twitch is waiting.
You'll finish the kid?
Yes. Go on, go.
Dr. Rayburn?
Had patients in Stevens Memorial.
This was the Norway South Paris Hospital.
He's on his way, Rusty. Go.
He paused on his way out to tell Mrs. Drake that Benny was fine. Alva did not seem overjoyed at the news, but thanked him. Dougie Twitchell, Twitch,
was sitting on the bumper of the out-of-date ambulance Jim Rennie and his fellow selectmen kept not replacing, smoking a cigarette and taking some sun. He was holding a portable CB, and it was lively with talk, voices popping like corn and jumping all over each other.
"Put out that cancer stick and let's get rolling," Rusty said. "You know where we're going, right?"
Twitch flipped the butt away. Despite his nickname, he was the calmest nurse Rusty had ever encountered, and that was saying a lot.
"I know what Jinjin told you. Tarkert's Chester's town line, right?"
"Yes, overturned truck."
"Yeah, well, plans have changed. We gotta go the other way."
He pointed to the southern horizon where a thick black pillar of smoke was rising.
"Ever had a desire to see a crashed plane?"
"I have," Rusty said. "In the service, two guys, you could have spread what was left on bread. That was plenty for me, Pilgrim. Ginny says they're all dead out there, so why?"
"Maybe so, maybe no," Twitch said. "But now Perkins is down, and he might not be."
"Chief Perkins?"
"The very same. I'm thinking the prognosis ain't good if the pacemaker blew right out of his chest, which is what Peter Randolph is claiming. But he is the chief of police. Fearless leader."
"Twitch, buddy, a pacemaker can't blow like that. It's perfectly impossible."
"Then maybe he is still alive, and we can do some good," Twitch said.
Halfway around the hood of the ambo, he took out his cigarettes. "You're not smoking in the ambulance," Rusty said. Twitch looked at him sadly. "Unless you share, that is." Twitch sighed and handed him the pack.
"Ah, Marlboros," Rusty said. "My very favorite OPs."
"You slay me," Twitch said.
5. They blew through the stoplight where Route 117 teed into 119 at the center of town. Siren blaring, both of them smoking like fiends, with the windows open, which was S.O.P., listening to the chatter from the radio. Rusty understood little of it, but he was clear on one thing. He was going to be working long past 4 o'clock.
"Man, I don't know what happened," Twitch said, "but there's this. We're going to see a genuine aircraft crash site. Post-crash, true, but beggars cannot be choosers."
"Twitch, you're one sick canine."
There was a lot of traffic, mostly headed south. A few of these folks might have legitimate errands, but Rusty thought most were human flies being drawn to the smell of blood. Twitch passed a line of 4 with no problem. The northbound lane of 119 was oddly empty.
"Look," Twitch said, pointing. "News chopper. We're going to be on the 6 o'clock news, Big Rusty. Heroic paramedics fight to..."
But that was where Dougie Twitchell's flight of fancy ended. Ahead of them, at the accident site, Rusty presumed, the helicopter did a button hook. For a moment, he could read the number 13 on its side and see the CBSI. Then, it exploded, raining down fire from the cloudless early afternoon sky. Twitch cried out,
"Jesus! I'm sorry. I didn't mean it."
And then childishly, hurting Rusty's heart even in his shock,
"I take it back."
6.
"Now I gotta go back," Gendron said.
He took off his sea dog's cap and wiped his bloody, grimy, pallid face with it. His nose had swollen until it looked like a giant's thumb. His eyes peered out of dark circles.
"I'm sorry, but my schnoz is hurting like hell, and, well, I ain't as young as I used to be. Also..."
He raised his arms and dropped them. They were facing each other, and Barbie would have taken the guy in his arms and given him a pat on the back if it were possible. "Shock to the system, isn't it?" he asked Gendron. Gendron gave a bark of laughter.
"That copter was the final touch."
And they both looked toward the fresh column of smoke. Barbie and Gendron had gone on from the accident site on 117 after making sure that the witnesses were getting help for Elsa Andrews, the sole survivor. At least she didn't seem badly hurt, although she was clearly heartbroken over the loss of her friend. "Going back then, slow. Take your time. Rest when you need to."
"Pushing on?"
"Yes."
"Still think you're going to find the end of it?"
Barbie was silent for a moment.
At first, he'd been sure, but now...
I hope so, he said.
Well, good luck.
Gendron tipped his cap to Barbie before putting it back on.
I hope to shake your hand before the day's out.
Me too, Barbie said. He paused. He had been thinking. Can you do something for me if you can get to your cell phone?
Sure.
Call the Army base at Fort Benning. Ask for the liaison officer and tell them you need to get in touch with Colonel James O. Cox. Tell them it's urgent, that you're calling for Captain Dale Barbara. Can you remember that?
Dale Barbara, that's you. James Cox, that's him. Got it.
If you reach him, I'm not sure you will, but if, tell him what's going on here. Tell him if no one's gotten in touch with Homeland Security, he's the man. Can you do that?
Gendron nodded.
If I can, I will. Good luck, soldier.
Barbie could have done without ever having been called that again, but he touched a finger to his forehead. Then he went on, looking for what he no longer thought he would find. 7. He found a woods road that roughly paralleled the barrier. It was overgrown and disused, but much better than pushing through the pucker brush. Every now and then he diverted to the west, feeling for the wall between Chester's Mill and the outside world. He was always there. When Barbie came to where 119 crossed into the mill's sister town of Tarker's Mills, he stopped. The driver of the overturned delivery truck had been taken away by some Good Samaritan on the other side of the barrier, but the truck itself lay blocking the road like a big dead animal. The back doors had sprung open on impact. The tar was littered with devil dogs, ho-hos, ring-dings, Twinkies, and peanut butter crackers. A young man in a George Strait t-shirt sat on a stump, eating one of the latter. He had a cell phone in hand. He looked up at Barbie.
Yo, did you come from...
He pointed vaguely behind Barbie. He looked tired and scared and disillusioned. From the other side of town, Barbie said. Right.
Invisible wall the whole way. Border closed.
Yes. The young man nodded and hit a button on his cell.
Dusty? You there yet?
He listened some more, then said,
okay.
He ended the call.
My friend Dusty and I started east of here. Split up. He went south. We've been staying in touch by phone. When we can get through, that is. He's where the copter crashed now. Says it's getting crowded there.
Barbie bet it was.
No break in this thing anywhere on your side?
The young man shook his head. He didn't say more, and didn't need to. They could have missed breaks. Barbie knew that was possible. Holes the size of windows or doors. But he doubted it. He thought they were cut off.
We all support the team. 1. Barbie walked back down Route 119 into the center of town, a distance of about 3 miles. By the time he got there, it was 6 o'clock. Main Street was almost deserted, but alive with the roar of generators, dozens of them by the sound. The traffic light at the intersection of 119 and 117 was dark, but Sweetbriar Rose was lit and loaded. Looking through the big front window, Barbie saw that every table was taken. But when he walked in the door, he heard none of the usual big talk. Politics, the Red Sox, the local economy, the Patriots, newly acquired cars and pick-em-ups, the Celtics, the price of gas, the Bruins, newly acquired power tools, the Twin Mills Wildcats, none of the usual laughter, either. There was a TV over the counter, and everyone was watching it. Barbie observed, with that sense of disbelief and dislocation everyone who actually finds him or herself at the site of a major disaster must feel, that CNN's Anderson Cooper was standing out on Route 119 with the still-smoldering hulk of the wrecked pulp truck in the background. Rose herself was waiting table, occasionally darting back to the counter to take an order. Wispy locks of hair were escaping her net and hanging around her face. She looked tired and harried. The counter was supposed to be Angie McCain's territory from 4 until closing, but Barbie saw no sign of her tonight. Perhaps she'd been out of town when the barrier slammed down. If that were the case, she might not be back behind the counter for a good long while. Anson Wheeler, whom Rosie usually just called the kid, although the guy had to be at least 25, was cooking. And Barbie dreaded to think what Ants might do to anything more complicated than Beans and Franks, the traditional Saturday night special at Sweetbriar Rose. Woe to the fellow or gal who ordered breakfast for dinner and had to face Anson's nuclear fried eggs. Still, it was good he was here, because in addition to the missing Angie, there was also no sign of Dodie Sanders, although that particular drip didn't need a disaster to keep her away from work. She wasn't lazy, exactly, but she was easily distracted, and when it came to brain power, geez, what could you say? Her father, Andy Sanders, the mill's first selectman, would never be a Mensa candidate, but Dodie made him look like Albert Einstein. On the TV, helicopters were landing behind Anderson Cooper, blowing his groovy white hair around and nearly drowning his voice. The copters looked like Pavlos. Barbie had ridden in his share during his time in Iraq. Now an army officer walked into the picture, covered Cooper's mic with one gloved hand, and spoke in the reporter's ear. The assembled diners in Sweetbriar Rose murmured among themselves. Barbie understood their disquiet. He felt it himself. When a man in a uniform covered a famous TV reporter's mic without so much as a by your leave, it was surely the end of days. The army guy, a colonel, but not his colonel, seeing Cox would have completed Barbie's sense of mental dislocation, finished what he had to say. His glove made a windy whoop sound when he took it off the mic. He walked out of the shot, his face a stolid blank. Barbie recognized the look. Army pod person. Cooper was saying, "The press is being told we have to fall back half a mile to a place called Raymond's Roadside Store." The patrons murmured again at this. They all knew Raymond's Roadside in Motton, where the sign in the window said, "Cold beer, hot sandwiches, fresh bait." This area, less than 100 yards from what we're calling the barrier, for want of a better term, has been declared a national security site. We'll resume our coverage as soon as we can, but right now I'm sending it back to you in Washington, Wolf. The headline on the red band beneath the location shot read, "Breaking news, main town, cut off, mystery deepens." And in the upper right-hand corner in red, the word "severe" was blinking, like a neon tavern sign. "Drink severe beer," Barbie thought, and nearly chuckled. Wolf Blitzer took Anderson Cooper's place. Rose had a crush on Blitzer, and would not allow the TV to be tuned to anything but the Situation Room on weekday afternoons. She called him "My Wolfie." This evening, Wolfie was wearing a tie, but it was badly knotted, and Barbie thought the rest of his clothes looked suspiciously like Saturday grubs. "Recapping our story," Rose's Wolfie said, "this afternoon at roughly 1 o'clock. 'Twas earlier than that and by quite a patch," someone said. "Is it true about Myra Evans?" someone else asked. "Is she really dead?"
"Yes,"
Fernald Bowie said. The town's only undertaker, Stuart Bowie, was Fern's older brother. Fern sometimes helped him out when he was sober, and he looked sober tonight. Shocked sober.
"Now shut your quack so I can hear this."
Barbie wanted to hear it too, because Wolfie was even now addressing the question Barbie cared most about, and saying what Barbie wanted to hear, that the airspace over Chester's Mill had been declared a no-fly zone. In fact, all of western Maine and eastern New Hampshire, from Lewiston, Auburn to North Conway, was a no-fly zone. The president was being briefed. And for the first time in 9 years, the color of the National Threat Advisory had exceeded orange. Julia Shumway, owner and editor of The Democrat, shot Barbie a glance as he passed her table. Then the pinched and secretive little smile that was her specialty, almost her trademark, flickered on her face. "It seems that Chester's Mill doesn't want to let you go, Mr. Barbara." "So it seems," Barbie agreed. That she knew he had been leaving, and why, didn't surprise him. He spent enough time in the mill to know Julia Shumway knew everything worth knowing. Rose saw him as she was serving Beans and Franks, plus a smoking relic that might once have been a pork chop, to a party of 6 crammed around a table for 4. She froze with a plate in each hand and 2 more on her arm, eyes wide. Then she smiled. It was one full of undisguised happiness and relief, and it lifted his heart. "This is what home feels like," he thought,
goddamned if it isn't.
Good gravy, I never expected to see you again, Dale Barbara.
You still got my apron? Barbie asked, a little shyly. Rose had taken him in, after all, just a drifter with a few scribbled references in his backpack and given him work. She had told him she completely understood why he felt he had to blow town. Junior Rennie's dad wasn't a fellow you wanted for an enemy, but Barbie still felt as if he'd left her in the lurch. Rose put down her load of plates anywhere there was room for them and hurried to Barbie. She was a plump little woman, and she had to stand on tiptoe to hug him, but she managed.
I am so goddamn glad to see you, she whispered.
Barbie hugged her back and kissed the top of her head. Big Jim and Junior won't be, he said. But at least neither Rennie was here. There was that to be grateful for. Barbie was aware that, for the time being at least, he had become even more interesting to the assembled Millites than their very own town on national TV.
Big Jim Rennie can blow me, she said.
Barbie laughed, delighted by her fierceness, but glad for her discretion. She was still whispering.
I thought you were gone.
I almost was, but I got a late start.
Did you see it?
Yes. Tell you later. He released her, held her at arm's length, and thought, if you were 10 years younger, Rose, or even 5. So I can have my apron back? She wiped the corners of her eyes and nodded.
Please, take it back. Get Anson out of there before he kills us all.
Barbie gave her a salute, then hooked around the corner into the kitchen and sent Anson Wheeler to the counter, telling him to take care of orders and clean up there before helping Rose in the main room. Anson stepped back from the grill with a sigh of relief. Before going to the counter, he shook Barbie's right hand in both of his.
Thank God, man. I never seen such a rush. I was lost.
Don't worry. We're going to feed the 5,000. Anson, no biblical scholar, looked blank.
Huh?
Never mind. The bell sitting in the corner of the pass-through binged.
Order up, Rose called.
Barbie grabbed a spatula before taking the slip. The grill was a mess, it always was, when Anson was engaged in those cataclysmic heat-induced changes he called cooking. Then slipped his apron over his head, tied it in back, and checked the cabinet over the sink. It was full of baseball caps, which served Sweetbriar Rose grill monkeys as chef's toques. He selected a sea dog's cap in honor of Paul Gendron, now in the bosom of his nearest and dearest, Barbie hoped, yanked it on backward, and cracked its knuckles. Then he grabbed the first slip and went to work. 2. By 9:15, more than an hour after their usual Saturday night closing time, Rose ushered the final patrons out. Barbie locked the door and turned the sign from open to closed. He watched those last 4 or 5 cross the street to the town common, where there were as many as 50 people gathered and talking among themselves. They were facing south, where a great white light formed a bubble over 119. Not TV lights, Barbie judged. That was the U.S. Army, creating and securing a perimeter. And how did you secure a perimeter at night? Why, by posting sentries and lighting the dead zone, of course. Dead zone. He didn't like the sound of that. Main Street, on the other hand, was unnaturally dark. There were electric lights shining in some of the buildings, where there were Jennies at work, and battery-powered emergency lights shining in Burpee's department store, the gas and grocery, Mill New and Used Books, Food City at the foot of Main Street Hill, and half a dozen others. But the streetlights were dark, and there were candles shining in the windows of most of Main Street's second-floor windows, where there were apartments. Rose sat at a table in the middle of the room, smoking a cigarette. Illegal in public buildings, but Barbie would never tell. She pulled the net off her head and gave Barbie a wan smile as he sat down across from her. Behind them, Anson was swabbing the counter, his own shoulder-length hair now liberated from its Red Sox cap.
I thought 4th of July was bad, but this was worse, Rose said. If you hadn't turned up, I'd be curled in the corner screaming for my mommy.
There was a blonde in an F-150, Barbie said, smiling at the memory. She almost gave me a ride. If she had, I might have been out. On the other hand, what happened to Chuck Thompson and the woman in that airplane with him might have happened to me. Thompson's name had been part of CNN's coverage. The woman hadn't been identified. But Rose knew.
It was Claudette Sanders,
I'm almost sure it was. Dodie told me yesterday that her mom had a lesson today.
There was a plate of French fries between them on the table. Barbie had been reaching for one. Now he stopped. All at once, he didn't want any more fries. Any more of anything. And the red puddle on the side of the plate looked more like blood than ketchup. So that's why Dodie didn't come in. Rose shrugged.
Maybe. I can't say for sure. I haven't heard from her. Didn't really expect to with the phones out.
Barbie assumed she meant the landlines, but even from the kitchen he'd heard people complaining about trouble getting through on their cells. Most assumed it was because everyone was trying to use them at the same time, jamming the band. Some thought the influx of TV people, probably hundreds by this time, toting Nokias, Motorolas, iPhones, and Blackberries, was causing the problem. Barbie had darker suspicions. This was a national security situation, after all, in a time when the whole country was paranoid about terrorism. Some calls were getting through, but fewer and fewer as the evening went on.
Of course, Rose said, Dodes might also have taken it into that airhead of hers to blow off work and go to the Auburn Mall.
Does Mr. Sanders know it was Claudette in the plane?
I can't say for sure, but I'd be awfully surprised if he doesn't know by now.
And she sang, in a small but tuneful voice.
It's a small town, you know what I mean?
Barbie smiled a little and sang the next line back to her. Just a small town, baby. And we all support the team. It was from an old James McMurtry song that had the previous summer gained a new and mysterious 2-month vogue on a couple of Western Maine C&W stations. Not WCIK, of course. James McMurtry was not the sort of artist Jesus Radio supported. Rose pointed to the French fries.
You gonna eat any more of those?
Nope. Lost my appetite. Barbie had no great love for either the endlessly grinning Andy Sanders or for Dodie the Dim, who had almost certainly helped her good friend Angie spread the rumor that had caused Barbie's trouble at Dippers. But the idea that those body parts, it was the green-clad leg his mind's eye kept trying to look at, had belonged to Dodie's mother, the first selectman's wife.
Me too,
Rose said, and put her cigarette out in the ketchup. It made a sound, and for one awful moment Barbie thought he was going to throw up. He turned his head and gazed out the window onto Main Street, although there was nothing to see from in here. From in here it was all dark.
President's going to speak at midnight, Anson announced from the counter.
From behind him came the low, constant groan of the dishwasher. It occurred to Barbie that the big old Hobart might be doing its last chore. At least for a while. He would have to convince Rosie of that. She'd be reluctant, but she'd see sense. She was a bright and practical woman. Dodie Sanders' mother, Jesus, what are the odds? He realized that the odds were actually not that bad. If it hadn't been Mrs. Sanders, it might well have been someone else he knew. It's a small town, baby. And we all support the team.
No president for me tonight, Rose said. He'll have to God bless America on his own. 5 o'clock comes early.
Sweetbriar Rose didn't open until 7 on Sunday mornings, but there was prep, always prep. And on Sundays, that included cinnamon rolls.
You boys stay up and watch if you want to. Just make sure we're locked up tight when you leave, front and back.
She started to rise. Rose, we need to talk about tomorrow, Barbie said.
Fiddle-dee-dee, tomorrow is another day. Let it go for now, Barbie, all in good time.
But she must have seen something on his face because she sat back down.
All right, why the grim look?
When's the last time you got propane?
Last week, we're almost full. Is that all you're worried about?
It wasn't, but it was where his worries started. Barbie calculated. Sweetbriar Rose had 2 tanks hooked together. Each tank had a capacity of either 325 or 350 gallons. He couldn't remember which. He'd check in the morning. But if Rose was right, she had over 600 gallons on hand. That was good. A bit of luck on a day that had been spectacularly unlucky for the town as a whole. But there was no way of knowing how much bad luck could still be ahead. And 600 gallons of propane wouldn't last forever. What's the burn rate? He asked her. Any idea?
Why does that matter?
Because right now your generator is running this place. Lights, stoves, fridges, pumps. The furnace, too, if it gets cold enough to kick on tonight. And the Jenny is eating propane to do it.
They were quiet for a moment, listening to the steady roar of the almost new Honda behind the restaurant. Anson Wheeler came over and sat down.
The Jenny sucks 2 gallons of propane an hour at 60% utilization, he said.
How do you know that? Barbie asked.
Read it on the tag. Running everything like we have since around noon, when the power went out, it probably ate 3 an hour, maybe a little more.
Rose's response was immediate.
Ants, kill all the lights but the ones in the kitchen, right now, and turn the furnace thermostat down to 50.
She considered.
No. Turn it off.
Barbie smiled and gave her a thumbs up. She got it. Not everyone in the mill would. Not everyone in the mill would want to.
Okay.
But Anson looked doubtful.
You don't think by tomorrow morning, tomorrow afternoon at the latest?
The President of the United States is going to make a TV speech, Barbie said, at midnight. What do you think, Ants?
I think I better turn off the lights, he said.
And the thermostat, don't forget that, Rose said.
As he hurried away, she said to Barbie, I'll do the same in my place when I go up. A widow for 10 years or more, she lived over her restaurant.
Barbie nodded.
He had turned over one of the paper placemats. Have you visited these 20 main landmarks? And was figuring on the back. 27 to 30 gallons of propane burned since the barrier went up. That left 570. If Rose could cut her use back to 25 gallons a day, she could theoretically keep going for 3 weeks. Cut back to 20 gallons a day, which she could probably do by closing between breakfast and lunch, and again between lunch and dinner, and she could press on for nearly a month. Which is fine enough, he thought, because if this town isn't open again after a month, there won't be anything here to cook anyway.
What are you thinking? Rose asked. And what's up with those numbers? I have no idea what they mean.
Because you're looking at them upside down, Barbie said, and realized everyone in town was apt to do the same. These were figures no one would want to look at right side up. Rose turned Barbie's makeshift scratch pad toward her. She ran the numbers for herself. Then she raised her head and looked at Barbie, shocked. At that moment, Anson turned most of the lights out, and the two of them were staring at each other in a gloom that was, to Barbie at least, horribly persuasive. They could be in real trouble here.
28 days, she asked. You think we need to plan for 4 weeks?
I don't know if we do or not, but when I was in Iraq, someone gave me a copy of Chairman Mao's little red book. I carried it around in my pocket, read it cover to cover. Most of it makes more sense than our politicians do on their sanest days. One thing that stuck with me was this. Wish for sunshine, but build dikes. I think that's what we, she said, and touched his hand. He turned his over and clasped it. Okay, we. I think that's what we have to plan for, which means closing between meals, cutting back on the ovens, no cinnamon rolls, even though I love them as much as anybody, and no dishwasher. It's old and energy inefficient. I know Dodie and Anson won't love the idea of washing dishes by hand.
I don't think we can count on Dodie coming back soon, maybe not at all. Not with her mother dead.
Rose sighed.
I almost hope she did go to the Auburn Mall. Although I suppose it'll be in the papers tomorrow.
Maybe. Barbie had no idea how much information was going to come out of or into Chester's Mill if this situation didn't resolve quickly and with some rational explanation. Probably not much. He thought Maxwell Smart's fabled cone of silence would descend soon, if it hadn't already. Anton came back to the table where Barbie and Rose were sitting. He had his jacket on.
Is it okay for me to go now, Rose?
Sure, she said. 6 tomorrow?
Isn't that a little late?
He grinned and added, not that I'm complaining.
We're going to open late, she hesitated, and close between meals.
Really? Cool.
His gaze shifted to Barbie.
You got a place to stay tonight because you could stay with me. Seda went to Derry to visit her folks.
Seda was Anson's wife. Barbie, in fact, did have a place to go. Almost directly across the street. Thanks, but I'll go back to my apartment. I'm paid up until the end of the month, so why not? I dropped off the keys with Petra Searles in the drugstore before I left this morning, but I still have a dupe on my key ring.
Okay, see you in the morning, Rose.
Will you be here, Barbie? Wouldn't miss it.
Anson's grin widened. Excellent. When he was gone, Rose rubbed her eyes, then looked at Barbie grimly. How long is this going to go on? Best guess.
I don't have a best guess because I don't know what happened, or when it will stop happening.
Very low, Rose said,
Bobby, you're scaring me.
I'm scaring myself. We both need to go to bed. Things will look better in the morning.
After this discussion, I'll probably need an Ambien to get to sleep, she said, tired as I am, but thank God you came back.
Barbie remembered what he'd been thinking about supplies. One other thing. If Food City opens tomorrow, it's always open on Sundays, 10 to 6. If it opens tomorrow, you need to go shopping.
But Cisco delivers on...
She broke off and stared at him dismally.
On Tuesdays. But we can't count on that, can we? Of course not.
No, he said. Even if what's wrong suddenly becomes right, the army's apt to quarantine this burg. At least for a while.
What should I buy?
Everything, but especially meat. Meat, meat, meat. If the store opens, I'm not sure it will. Jim Rennie may persuade whoever manages it now.
Jack Cale, he took over when Ernie Calvert retired last year.
Well, Rennie may persuade him to close until further notice, or get Chief Perkins to order the place closed.
You don't know, Rose asked, and at his blank look. You don't? Duke Perkins is dead, Bobby. He died out there.
She gestured south. Barbie stared at her, stunned. Anson had neglected to turn off the television, and behind them, Rose's Wolfie was again telling the world that an unexplained force had cut off a small town in western Maine. The area had been isolated by the armed forces. The Joint Chiefs were meeting in Washington. The president would address the nation at midnight. But in the meantime, he was asking the American people to unite their prayers for the people of Chester's Mill with his own. 3.
Dad. Dad.
Junior Rennie stood at the top of the stairs, head cocked, listening. There was no response, and the TV was silent. His dad was always home from work, and in front of the TV by now. On Saturday nights, he forewent CNN and Fox News for either Animal Planet or the History Channel. Not tonight, though. Junior listened to his watch to make sure it was still ticking. It was. And what it said sort of made sense, because it was dark outside. A terrible thought occurred to him. Big Jim might be with Chief Perkins. The two of them could at this minute be discussing how to arrest Junior with the least possible fuss. And why had they waited so long? So they could spirit him out of town under cover of darkness. Take him to the county jail over in Castle Rock. Then a trial. And then... Then Shawshank. After a few years there, he'd probably just call it the Shank, like the rest of the murderers, robbers, and sodomites. That's stupid, he whispered. But was it? He'd awakened thinking that killing Angie had just been a dream. Must have been, because he would never kill anyone. Beat them up, maybe, but kill? Ridiculous. He was, a regular person. Then he'd looked at the clothes under the bed, seen the blood on them, and it all came back. The towel falling off her hair, her pussy patch somehow goading him. The complicated crunching sound from behind her face when he'd gotten her with his knee. The rain of fridge magnets, and the way she had thrashed. But that wasn't me, it was the headache. Yes, true, but who'd believe that? He'd have better luck if he said the butler did it.
Dad!
Nothing. Not here. Not at the police station, conspiring against him either. Not his dad. He wouldn't. His dad always said family came first. But did family come first? Of course he said that. He was a Christian, after all, and half-owner of WCIK. But Junior had an idea that for his dad, Jim Rennie's used cars might come before family, and that being the town's first selectman might come before the holy tabernacle of no money down. Junior could be, it was possible, third in line. He realized for the first time in his life it was a genuine flash of insight, that he was only guessing, that he might not really know his father at all. He went back to his room and turned on the overhead. It cast an odd, unsteady light, waxing bright, and then dim. For a moment, Junior thought something was wrong with his eyes. Then he realized he could hear their generator running out back,
and not just theirs either. The town's power was out. He felt a surge of relief. A big power outage explained everything. It meant his father was likely in the town hall conference room, discussing matters with those other two idiots, Sanders and Grinnell. Maybe sticking pins in the big map of the town, making like George Patton, yelling at Western Maine Power and calling them a bunch of lazy cotton pickers. Junior got his bloody clothes, raked the shit out of his jeans, wallet, change, keys, comb, and extra headache pill, and redistributed it in the pockets of his clean pants. He hurried downstairs, stuck the incriminating garments in the washer, set it for hot, then reconsidered, remembering something his mother had told him when he was no more than 10, cold water for bloodstains. As he moved the dial to cold wash, cold rinse, Junior wondered idly if his dad had started his hobby of secretary fucking way back then, or if he was still keeping his cotton-picking penis at home. He started the washer going and thought about what to do next. With the headache gone, he found that he could think. He decided he should go back to Angie's house after all. He didn't want to. God almighty, it was the last thing he wanted to do. But he probably should scope out the scene, walk past and see how many police cars were there. Also, whether or not the Castle County forensics van was there. Forensics was key. He knew that from watching CSI. He'd seen the big blue and white van before, while visiting the county courthouse with his dad. And if it was at the McCain's, I'll run. Yes, as fast and far as he could. But before he did, he'd come back here and visit the safe in his dad's study. His dad didn't think Junior knew the combo to that safe, but Junior did, just as he knew the password to his dad's computer, and thus about his dad's penchant for watching what Junior and Frank the Lesseps called Oreo sex. Two black chicks, one white guy. There was plenty of money in that safe. Thousands of dollars. What if you see the van and come back and he's here? The money first, then. The money right now. He went into the study and for a moment thought he saw his father sitting in the high back chair where he watched the news and nature programs. He'd fallen asleep, or what if he'd had a heart attack? Big Jim had had heart problems off and on for the last 3 years. Mostly arrhythmia. He usually went up to Kathy Russell and either Doc Haskell or Doc Rayburn buzzed him with something and got him back to normal. Haskell would have been content to keep on doing that forever. But Rayburn, whom his father called an overeducated cotton picker, had finally insisted that Big Jim see a cardiologist at CMG in Lewiston. The cardiologist said he needed a procedure to knock out that irregular heartbeat once and for all. Big Jim, who was terrified of hospitals, said he needed to talk to God more, and you called that a prayer procedure. Meantime, he took his pills, and for the last few months he'd seemed fine, but now, maybe... Dad? No answer. Junior flipped the light switch. The overhead gave that same unsteady glow, but it dispelled the shadow Junior had taken for the back of his father's head. He wouldn't be exactly heartbroken if his dad vapor-locked, but on the whole he was glad it hadn't happened tonight. There was such a thing as too many complications. Still, he walked to the wall where the safe was, with big, soft steps of cartoon caution, watching for the splash of headlights across the window that would herald his father's return. He set aside the picture that covered the safe, Jesus giving the Sermon on the Mount, and ran the combination. He had to do it twice before the handle would turn, because his hands were shaking. The safe was stuffed with cash and stacks of parchment-like sheets with the words Bearer Bonds stamped on them. Junior gave a low whistle. The last time he'd opened this, to filch 50 for last year's Freiburg Fair, there had been plenty of cash, but nowhere near this much. And no bearer bonds. He thought of the plaque on his father's desk at the car store. Would Jesus approve of this deal? Even in his distress and fear, Junior found time to wonder if Jesus would approve of whatever deal his dad had going on the side these days. Never mind his business, I gotta run mine, he said in a low voice. He took 550s and 20s, started to close the safe, reconsidered, and took some of the hundreds as well. Given the obscene glut of cash in there, his dad might not even miss it. If he did, it was possible he'd understand why Junior had taken it, and might approve. As Big Jim always said, the Lord helps those who help themselves. In that spirit, Junior helped himself to another 400. Then he closed the safe, spun the combo, and hung Jesus back on the wall. He grabbed a jacket from the front hall closet and went out while the generator roared and the Maytag sudsed Angie's blood from his clothes. 4. There was no one at the McCain's house. Fucking no one. Junior lurked on the other side of the street in a moderate shower of maple leaves, wondering if he could trust what he was seeing. The house, dark, Henry McCain's 4Runner and LaDonna's Prius still not in evidence. It seemed too good to be true, far too good. Maybe they were on the town common. A lot of people were tonight. Possibly they were discussing the power failure, although Junior couldn't remember any such gatherings before when the lights went out. People mostly went home and went to bed, sure that, unless there'd been a whopper of a storm, the lights would be back on when they got up for breakfast. Maybe this power failure had been caused by some spectacular accident, the kind of thing the TV news broke into regular coverage to report. Junior had a vague memory of some geezer asking him what was going on not long after Angie had her own accident. In any case, Junior had taken care to speak to nobody on his way over here. He had walked along Main Street with his head down and his collar turned up. He had, in fact, almost bumped into Anson Wheeler as Ants left Sweetbriar Rose. The streetlights were out, and that helped preserve his anonymity. Another gift from the gods. And now this. A third gift. A gigantic one. Was it really possible that Angie's body hadn't been discovered yet? Or was he looking at a trap? Junior could picture the Castle County Sheriff or a state police detective saying, "We only have to keep out of sight and wait, boys. The killer always revisits the scene of his crime. It's a well-known fact." TV bullshit. Still, as he crossed the street, drawn, it seemed, by a force outside himself, Junior kept expecting spotlights to go on, pinning him like a butterfly on a piece of cardboard. Kept expecting someone to shout, probably through a bullhorn, "Stop where you are and get those hands in the air." Nothing happened. When he reached the foot of the McCain driveway, heart skittering in his chest and blood thumping in his temples. Still no headache, though, and that was good, a good sign. The house remained dark and silent. Not even a generator roaring, although there was one at the Grinnells next door. Junior looked over his shoulder and saw a vast white bubble of light rising above the trees. Something at the south end of town, or perhaps over in Motton. The source of the accident that had killed the power? Probably. He went to the back door. The front door would still be unlocked if no one had returned since Angie's accident, but he didn't want to go in the front. He would if he had to, but maybe he wouldn't. He was, after all, on a roll. The doorknob turned. Junior stuck his head into the kitchen and smelled the blood at once. An odor a little like spray starch, only gone stale. He said, "Hi. Hello. Anybody home?" Almost positive there wasn't. But if someone was, if by some crazy chance Henry or LaDonna had parked over by the common and returned on foot, somehow missing their daughter lying dead on the kitchen floor, he would scream. Yes, scream, and discover the body. That wouldn't do anything about the dreaded forensics van, but it would buy him a little time. "Hello? Mr. McCain? Mrs. McCain?" And then, in a flash of inspiration, "Angie, are you home?" Would he call her like that if he'd killed her? Of course not. But then a terrible thought lanced through him. What if she answered? Answered from where she was lying on the floor. Answered through a throat full of blood. "Get a grip," he muttered. Yes, he had to, but it was hard. Especially in the dark. Besides, in the Bible, stuff like that happened all the time. In the Bible, people sometimes return to life like the zombies in Night of the Living Dead. "Anybody home?" Zip. Nada. His eyes had adjusted to the gloom, but not enough. He needed a light. He should have brought a flashlight from the house, but it was easy to forget stuff like that when you were used to just flipping a switch. Junior crossed the kitchen, stepping over Angie's body, and opened the first of two doors on the far side. It was a pantry. He could just make out the shelves of bottled and canned goods. He tried the other door and had better luck. It was the laundry. And unless he was mistaken about the shape of the thing standing on the shelf just to his right,